This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents Selling the Invisible, written by Harry Beckwith and read by Jeffrey Jones.
You can't see them, so how do you sell them? That's the problem with services. I learned this 14 years ago when I wrote my first ad for a service. It wasn't a product. I couldn't show the service doing anything because services are invisible. Services are just promises that somebody will do something. How do you sell that? You cannot hear the hum of a tax return being prepared, smell a good divorce attorney, or try on a dry cleaner to see if it flatters you. In most cases, you buy a service, touch, taste, feel, smell, and sight unseen. Few services have price tags. You interview a service to redo your kitchen, revise your company's pension plan, or cater your anniversary party. At that moment, you probably do not know the cost and fear what it might be. A representative of the service promises to go back to work up an estimate. Because most services cannot be warranted, your only recourse for most service failures is either painful negotiation or agonizing litigation. So, you buy a service with no guarantees and even more uncertainty. Compared to products, services are loose cannons on deck, capable of pivoting around and blowing up the ship any minute. So, as a service marketer, doctor or architect, dry cleaner or accounting firm, broker or house painter, you face prospects almost shaking with worry and sensitive to any mistake you might make. That is where your marketing must start, with a clear understanding of the worried soul in front of you. Even if you do not consider yourself a service marketer, if your business is pacemakers or cars or software, for example, this audiobook applies to you too, because chances are, you are a service marketer, or should be. These marketers focus more on relationships and less on features and benefits. They focus more on reality and on getting better reality, while recognizing the powerful influence of perceptions. They are learning more about the seemingly irrational ways in which people think and act. They recognize the huge influence of tiny things. They understand the near impossibility of being heard and the growing difficulty of being understood in our increasingly busy and over-communicated society. And perhaps more than anything else, these marketers recognize that in our increasingly complex world, nothing works more powerfully than simplicity. The new marketing is more than a way of doing, it is a way of thinking. It begins with an understanding of the distinctive characteristics of services, their invisibility and intangibility, and of the unique nature of service prospects and users, their fear, their limited time, their sometimes illogical ways of making decisions, and their most important drives and needs. Most people will equate the word marketing with selling and advertising, pushing the goods. We need better marketing invariably means we need to get our name out with ads, publicity, and maybe some direct mail. Unfortunately, this focus on getting the word outside distracts companies from the inside and from the first rule of service marketing. The core of service marketing is the service itself. What I am saying is, the first principle of service marketing is Guy Kawasaki's first principle of computer marketing. Get better reality. Better reality in your service will make marketing easier, cheaper, and more profitable. The first step in service marketing is your service. For years, we've heard that this is a cold, hard world. What makes us think that? It's not our family, friends, or neighbors. We get this idea from dealing with services. Will Beckwith, age 10, says it perfectly. Too often, service sucks. Why has service gotten so bad? It is partly because companies cannot show precisely that investing more in improving service, whether in training, salaries, or increased staffing, will earn them more. To improve their profits, Companies squeeze costs by squeezing their service until someone, usually the client, screams. First, before you write an ad, rent a list, dash off a press release, fix your service. Service in this country is so bad, you can offer above average service and still stink. By definition, the odds are that you're average. So, assume your service is bad. It can't hurt, and it will force you to improve, and forget the excuses. Ask, who is setting your standards? Your industry, your ego, or your clients? Let your clients set your standards. 20 years ago, I might have accepted bad service. 20 years ago, I also accepted restrooms carpeted with wet paper towels and waiters wearing ketchup-stained aprons and chewing bazooka bubblegum and 10-day delivery from catalogs. Then McDonald's came along and raised everyone's standards for restrooms. Better restaurants raised our expectations of waiters, and Federal Express raised our standards for catalog delivery. Those services changed our expectations forever. Now, we expect cleaner restrooms, faster services, and more attentive waiters. More people every day have experienced extraordinary service. Many have seen Disney World, and they know how clean, friendly, and creative service can be. They have seen world-class service, and now every service has to accept it. A service that does not jump to meet these rising expectations will have a small revolution and a customer exodus on its hands. Ignore your industry's benchmarks and copy Disney's. On September 16th, 1993, a Minneapolis man remembered that Dayton's suit department had promised that they would have his summer weight jacket repaired and ready by this afternoon. The executive approached the register and was met by an energetic, dark-haired clerk named Roger Azam. "I'm here for the jacket," the executive said. 3 minutes later, Azam returned from alterations with bad news.
"Sorry, not ready."
The executive had barely started to complain that his heart was set on getting the jacket when Roger disappeared, shouting, "Be right back!" Almost as quickly, Roger returned. "They will do it right now and have the jacket in 5 minutes, I promise," he said. The customer reacted as most people would. He was touched. The clerk had gone so far out of his way that the customer now felt indebted to him. While the customer waited, he started walking through three aisles of sports jackets. He spotted a handsome brown herringbone Hugo Boss jacket with a matching price tag, $575. Naturally, the story ends with the executive buying the jacket. But he also had to buy a $110 pair of black slacks and a $55 black, brown, and white striped tie to match them. Roger Azam's 5-minute dash up to alterations created a $740 sale, not to mention the value of all the publicity Dayton's is getting here right now for Roger's gesture. Roger Azam's story has another moral that many service marketers overlook. Even though effective service marketing starts with outstanding service does not mean zero defects. In Roger's case, Dayton's service actually had a gross defect. Dayton's had not delivered when promised. But Dayton's profited more from its mistake than it would have profited from perfect quality and zero defects, at least $740 more. Dayton's profited because Roger's customer knew that to err is human, and judged Dayton's and Roger by what he did after he noted the error. Big mistakes are big opportunities. The service and total quality bandwagons have raced through America's businesses and millions have jumped aboard. But the swirling dust from the bandwagons has obscured some riders' view of what makes a service business thrive. America's great service successes are not the companies that did what others did but a little better. They are the companies that decided to do things a whole lot differently. McDonald's did more than refine the classic American drive-in. McDonald's took a radical, meticulously orchestrated, incredibly process-driven approach to delivering good quality at great speed for a remarkably low price. Federal Express did more than refine mail delivery. It invented a thoroughly radical, logistically brilliant, and remarkably well-executed method for delivering packages over great distances at enormous speeds. Don't just think better, think different. The possible service. Want a good model for marketing your service in the 90s? Study the evolution of the automobile. The first car met only some minimum standards because that is what products and services do in stage one of any industry. Buyers accept this minimal product because they desire the unique benefits it offers. In stage two, competitors enter. Differentiation of this core product becomes vital. Enter the marketers. They listen, and they make refinements the customers ask for. Answering customer needs is the driving force during stage two. Few companies enter stage three. These companies are in the pantheon of marketing gods, the Disneys, the Federal Expresses, and the Lexuses. To differentiate itself clearly from the many competitors who are meeting its clients' expressed needs, the stage three company must make a leap. It must surprise the customer. Surprising the customer is the driving force in stage three. Stage three is imagination-driven, and a company in this stage offers the possible service. Don't just create what the market needs or wants. Create what it would love. I was recently left speechless after I told a client, "The first step to marketing a service is getting the service right. So find out if you have it right. Survey your clients. Ask." I wasn't ready for her response. "I don't want to do that," she said. "I'm afraid to hear what they think." Actually, it was good that she didn't want to hear, because I didn't want her to send the surveys anyway. I wanted an independent third party to send them. A basic principle in life applies to surveying clients. Even your best friends won't tell you, but they will talk behind your back. Make it so your clients can talk behind your back, and then you can learn what they're saying. Have a third party do your surveys. Why survey? Your customers will see that you're trying to improve your service. You can have customers score you in different areas and then publicize your high scores in your marketing materials. It gives credibility to your statements about your service quality. It gives you an opportunity to sell something or make an offer. It keeps contact with your clients. It lets you learn from your mistakes. It helps you flag possible problem areas and clients. It keeps you from coasting. It keeps you from wondering what you're doing wrong. It tells you what business you're in and what people really are buying. Now, how should you conduct a survey? With interviews or written questionnaires? Unless you are confident that you can interpret them, beware of written surveys. No written survey can clarify every word or use words that need no clarification, and no researcher can accurately interpret each word. But when you conduct oral surveys, you can clarify your questions and ask people to clarify their answers. Frankly speaking, phone surveys usually produce more revealing results. On the phone, people will open up and reveal the information you need. An experienced interviewer can be more conversational and relaxed with the subjects and can probe deeper. All of this helps produce more information. Typically, 40% of the people will respond to a written survey. In oral surveys, you can often get almost 100% response. Finally, a person's voice conveys feelings that her written words often obscure. For a dozen reasons, conduct oral surveys, not written ones. Marketing is not a department. The president of Seasonal Concepts, Albert Schneider, stresses how fragile a service business is. "We can have great talent, products, prices, and advertising, but if that sales clerk at the end of the line fails, everything fails. The buyer doesn't return, and if the buyer suffers a very bad experience, he tells all his friends not to come either." Everyone in your company is responsible for marketing your company. Marketing is not a department. It is your business. Tunnel vision. Tunnel vision, the inability of people to see the broad scope of their business, became so common that Harvard professor Theodore Levitt coined the now famous term for it: marketing myopia. The walls of a company seem to do more than keep the cold air out. They seem to block out a clear vision of the world. When companies discuss their problems, they talk about themselves. But what people really need to know, what you really need to know, is your customers and prospects. Get out. Climb out. Have someone pull you out of the tunnel. Start with you and your employees. Every employee should know that every act is a marketing act upon which your success depends. Review every step, from how your receptionist answers the phone to the message on the bottom of your invoices, and ask what you could do differently to attract and keep more customers. Every act is a marketing act. Make every employee a marketing person. Never mind what business you're in, every business planning its future should answer, what are you good at? Federal Express asked itself that in the 1980s when it realized it should diversify its portfolio. But what is Federal Express good at? The Federal Express industry mental model would lead you to answer, they're good at overnight delivery or fast package delivery. But Federal Express realized that what it is astonishingly good at is logistics. Federal Express is brilliant at procuring, distributing, and replacing materials. Recognizing this, the company established a consultancy that advises companies on logistical management. For years, accounting firms decided they were good at accounting. But Arthur Anderson realized that in becoming skilled in modern accounting, it had become very adept at understanding the information systems that push the numbers through companies. So the firm established what has become a well-regarded information management consulting practice. Your opportunities for growth often lie outside the confines of your current industry description. Your great opportunities are an answer to the question, what are we good at? In planning your marketing, don't just think of your business. Think of your skills. What are you really selling? People in the fast food business used to think they were selling food. Then McDonald's came along and figured out that people weren't buying hamburgers. People were buying an experience. Maybe you think prospects in your industry are looking for hamburgers. Chances are they want something else. The first company to figure out what that is wins. Find out what clients are really buying. One thing most experts don't know. Most companies in expert services, such as lawyers, doctors, and accountants, think that their clients are buying expertise. But most prospects for these complex services cannot evaluate expertise. They cannot tell a really good tax return, a clever motion, or a perceptive diagnosis. Your expertise is assumed. But they can tell if the relationship is good and if the phone calls are returned. If you're selling a service, you're selling a relationship. Who is your client? Carl often feels overlooked and insecure. Sharon wishes she knew more about you and knew she could trust you. Carl craves one thing above all. He craves appreciation. Before you try to satisfy the client, understand and satisfy the person. With whom are you really competing? Every great business school teaches competitive strategy, and every good marketing plan includes a section on competition. It appears that you should study your competitors, but service marketers must look at competitors through a wider lens. With few exceptions, companies are not battling to share that market. They are battling to create it, to get prospects to want and use their service instead of doing nothing or performing the service themselves. In many cases, and in many markets, among real estate consultants, extended warranty providers, public relations firms, telemarketers, collection agencies, interior decorators, fast food restaurants, income tax services, motivational speakers, and millions more, your prospect faces three options: using your service, doing it themselves, or not doing it at all. In many cases, then, your biggest competitors are not your competitors. They are your prospects. This means that your strategy cannot be competitive. Your real competitor is often sitting across the table. Plan accordingly. Hit 'em where they ain't. Sam Walton's brilliantly profitable strategy for Walmart was to go where no sane competitor like Woolworth or Kmart would dream of, to towns that seemed too small to support a large discount store.
Walton claimed these towns and their surroundings for himself, and his domination in these areas produced the profits that fed Walmart's growth into more and bigger communities. Just 30 years after opening that first store, Sam Walton died. He was America's richest man, and his company was America's largest retailer. The advice, go where they ain't, is not limited to location. A Pasadena, California attorney goes where they ain't by marketing himself as a motorcycle accident specialist, leaving the other personal injury attorneys to fight for the much larger and far more competitive market of automobile accident victims. Several large advertising agencies avoid competition for the large and ruthlessly competitive consumer products market by specializing in agricultural accounts. Go where others aren't. The adapter's edge. In service industry after industry, technology creates the adapter's edge. The adapters become more proficient sooner, work out the bugs, and quickly recognize the benefits of the technology. The real adapters learn and turn that learning into a great competitive advantage. Today, dozens of service companies are sleeping, content with how things have always been. The sleepers in those industries are so many fish in a barrel for the smart marketer who recognizes the many ways that technology can be applied to make customer service in that industry better, faster, cheaper, and more reliable. What does this mean? Every service company should have a director of technology who studies and regularly tells management how new technologies can be used for competitive advantage. In addition, every internal review of a company's marketing should ask four questions that have not been typical of marketing reviews until now. In our industry, are we second to none technologically? Among service industries and compared with firms of our approximate size, are we second to none technologically? Are we doing all we need today to be second to none 2 years from now? Have we carefully considered innovative ways that new technology can be used to improve our service and grow our business? Make technology a key part of every marketing plan. Voted best personality. When many prospects choose a service firm, they are not buying the firm's credentials, reputation, or industry stature. Instead, these prospects buy the firm's personality. I just liked them. I had a good feeling about them. It just felt like a good fit. Notice the words do not refer to logic and reason. They refer to feelings. Service businesses are about relationships. Winning is a matter of feelings, and feelings are about personalities. Be professional, but more important, be personable. Planning. The 18 fallacies. Fallacy. You can know what's ahead. The three cornerstones of planning, predicting the future, seeing what you want your future to look like, and devising ways to make sure your future comes out that way, are shaky from the start. People can't predict the future. Even if you can identify people's attitudes, you cannot predict the behavior that will follow. So, it seems our efforts to plan are at the mercy of something Einstein warned of years ago. The universe is not only queerer than we suppose, it's queerer than we can suppose. You never know, so don't assume that you should. Plan for several possible futures. Fallacy. You can know what you want. The second premise of planning, that you can know what you want in the future, is slightly dubious, too. Businesses don't like what they once wanted, so they change their minds. Most want to get bigger, then realize that bigger often means less profitable. A few companies yearn to be the very best, and then realize the market doesn't appreciate the quality and won't pay for it. Some companies want to attack a niche and then learn their competitors had good reason for avoiding that niche all those years. Does this mean that you shouldn't plan? Not at all. It does mean that everyone involved in planning should start with three ideas. First, accept the limitations of planning. Don't assume that putting eight smart people in a room with good data will automatically produce something. Ford had eight smart planners in a room and out popped the Edsel. Second, Don't value planning for its result, the plan. The greatest value of the plan is the process, the thinking that went into it. Third, don't plan your future, plan your people. Outstanding people who fit your basic broad vision will tend to make the right decision along the way, not by following a plan, but by using their skill. Fallacy. Strategy is king. Businesses once encouraged the view of strategy's superiority to tactics by throwing piles of money at it. But in successful companies, tactics drive strategy as much or more than strategy drives tactics. These companies do something, and they learn from it. It changes their thinking. Tactics don't complete a process. They continue to shape one. Tactics sometimes are the end, the beginning, and the middle. Most important, tactics play a critical role in information gathering. You do something, and you learn from it. By contrast, you can't learn by your strategy. It's just sitting there pretending it knows what it's talking about while your tactics are out there getting battle-tested by the market. I once advised a consultant who was vacillating among several reasonable marketing tactics. I had a button printed with two words of advice for him. Do anything. Fallacy. Build a better mousetrap. We still believe that if you build a better mousetrap, the world will start lining up on your porch. But too many examples today suggest otherwise. The computer industry has been packed with great ideas that were sitting in back rooms until someone dragged them out the door and pushed them with a passion. Xerox invented the mouse, icons, and Windows. The ideas were great, but they were only ideas. Only Apple's passionate belief in those ideas put them into play, into the Macintosh computer, and changed the world. Execute passionately. Marginal tactics executed passionately almost always will outperform brilliant tactics executed marginally. Fallacy. There'll be a perfect time. Years ago, a Bloomington-based company created some astonishingly good multimedia software. This company was just positioned to ride the multimedia wave. It was the wave. But the founders wanted an insanely great product. Did the world want that? No. The world wanted what the software company had right then. The company's endless analysis and waiting ended up proving that he who hesitates is lost. Other companies caught up, passed this company before the company released version 1.0. Today's good idea almost always will beat tomorrow's better one. Do it now. The business obituary pages are filled with planners who waited. Fallacy. Patience is a virtue. The shark rule. It appears that organizations actually are subject to the law that governs sharks. If a shark does not move, it cannot breathe, and it dies. Moving organizations tend to keep moving. Dormant ones tend to run out of air and die. To worsen this problem, not moving rarely causes any immediate pain to an organization. This encourages even more waiting. Not moving begets more not moving. By the time the delayed consequences of all this not moving occur, one of which is that action-oriented people in the company flee the company, making the company even more waiting-oriented, it is often too late to correct them. Act like a shark. Keep moving. Fallacy. Think smart. As we learn every day, highly intelligent people are the world's foremost experts at squashing good ideas. That's because intelligent people have one absolute favorite use for their formidable intelligence, telling other people with total conviction and logic why other people's ideas will not work. Planning tends to attract these people, but they are dangerous. As smart as they are, their memories fail them. They always forget that good ideas often sound ludicrous at first. Think dumb. The fallacy of science and data. Nothing said in a business meeting can match the force of any statement preceded by the words, "The research shows." That's because research connotes something scientific. The aura of science has a remarkable ability to fool people. Consider Stanford Research Institute's introduction of the VALS, Values, Attitudes, and Lifestyles concept to marketing planning of the mid-1980s. VALS concluded that there were seven types of people, a conclusion that many people initially bought. Did these people forget who they were? Like everyone else, these people had met thousands of people and, from that, learned that each person is unique. These people had searched for friendship and found very few people with whom they shared even a few things in common. But when the VALS people came along, well-educated and linked to a great university, and said, "There are seven types of people," many people bought it. Before long, commercials were touting coffee as the drink for the new achievers, the largest VALS segment during that yuppie era. Today, even hard scientists confess that their sciences look softer every day, and the soft sciences have little claim to science at all, even when they offer broad generalizations backed by numbers. Mistrust facts, and don't approach planning as a precise science. Planning is an imprecise art. The fallacy of focus groups. Occasionally, 1 + 1 = more than 2. Bill Birnbach discovered that in the late 1950s when he brought new imagination to advertising by bringing a new method to it. Birnbach believed in brainstorming, the process in which ideas ricochet between at least two people. He believed that if individuals can produce good ideas, teams can produce even better ones. Given that groups are good at brainstorming, perhaps many services might benefit from focus groups that brainstorm new ideas. They might. But consider some major innovations in service marketing. Automated teller machines. Negotiable certificates of deposit, storefront tax services, legal clinics, traveler's checks, overnight package delivery, frequent flyer and other loyalty marketing programs, credit cards, home shopping. Did focus groups generate any of those ideas? Could a focus group have generated any of those ideas? So, maybe focus groups can brainstorm for you, but you should never bet on it. Beware of focus groups. They focus only on today, and planning is about tomorrow. The fallacy of memory. We remember badly. We look back and see things that were not there. We cite as proof for something, an event that simply did not occur as we remember it. In planning, beware of what you think you remember. The fallacy of experience. They say people learn from experience. Some do. When we infer things, we tend to overgeneralize. We want to establish cubbyholes in some general principles. What does what you experience really prove? Usually, far less than you thought. And what you thought you learned can make you abandon a strategy or tactic that was 90% right. Have a healthy distrust of what experience has taught you. The fallacy of confidence. You hear sacred truths in every company. Often these sacred truths start with someone as a mere opinion, but many so-called truths are false, just like many of your truths about your service. The sobering fact that we are wrong far more often than we know has been suggested by dozens of studies that test people on subjects on which they consider themselves authorities. If you are prone to being certain, copy Jay Shiat, the head of Shiat Day, the ad agency behind many of America's most conspicuous advertisements. Shiat carries around a note in his pocket. The note reminds him that whenever he is in an argument, he should remember the note's three words. Maybe he's right. Maybe others are right and you're wrong, even if you're certain you're right. The tests which demonstrate the fallacy of confidence, the overconfidence bias, as it's called by psychologists, also tell you not to be overwhelmed by other people's total convictions. In fact, many businesses unwittingly follow the path of greatest conviction. They consistently do whatever the most convinced person argues they should do. So even when you or someone else feels certain, you should question that authority, especially your own. Beware of the overconfidence bias. Maybe he's right. Fallacy. Perfection is perfection. You can easily get stalled in the shift from strategy to tactics
because you are paralyzed by your desire for excellence. The planning process tends to attract perfectionists, but something paralyzes these people, their fear that executing the plan will show that the plan was not perfect, so rather than risk being found out, these people do nothing, they wait. Many outstanding big-picture thinkers are always looking for and burdened by this search for perfection. But too often, the path to perfection leads to procrastination. Don't let the perfect ruin good.
Fallacy. Failure is failure. Few phobias are more widespread than the fear of failure. But what is failure? Robert Townsend, who helped mastermind Avis's dramatic turnaround in the 1960s, said two of every three decisions he made were wrong. Fred Smith got a C on the graduate business school paper in which he described the concept for Federal Express. There's little point in killing an idea by saying it might fail. Any idea might fail. If you're doing anything worthwhile at all, you'll suffer a dozen failures. Start failing so you can start succeeding. The fallacy of expertise. Before you look to expert insight for help in planning, ask yourself, what is an expert? The Wall Street Journal periodically matches the nation's leading stock analysts against a handful of darts. Over the past year, the randomly thrown darts have consistently hit better stocks on the dartboard than those chosen by the experts after months of study and years of experience. The value of an expert's experience is dubious. Every experience in life is unique. Anytime we apply the apparent lessons from one experience to another one, we tend to assume that the two experiences are essentially identical. They never are. Don't look to experts for all your answers. There are no answers, only informed opinions. The fallacy of authority. Chances are your organization runs on the alpha principle. Ideas do not follow the good thinking in an organization. Ideas follow the power. Are alphas better at decision-making? Not necessarily. Alphas are just better at getting and keeping power. If your smart people don't kill your ideas, chances are the alphas will. If you're an alpha, learn to shut up. Imitate Ben Taylor, the alpha who runs the Executrain franchise in Minnesota, often the most successful of America's very successful Executrain franchises. When asked to explain his success, Taylor's first response is, "I listen." The bumper stickers are right. Question authority. Question alphas. The fallacy of common sense. A client once told me that doing a marketing plan is simple. It's just common sense. Unfortunately, common sense is not that common. Common sense did not inspire the great market innovations of this century, the L.L. Bean boot, the personal computer, overnight delivery, or any other. Leaps of imagination created them. Common sense will only get you so far. For inspiring results, you'll need inspiration. The fallacy of fate. There are fatalistic groups, fatalistic people, and fatalistic companies. Some people cannot picture success. Some people are afraid to believe in it because they're terrified of disappointment, and most people will say, "We tried something like that. It didn't work." The New York Mets didn't have a prayer in the 1969 World Series. They had been laughed at for years. Their relief pitcher, Tug McGraw, implored them, "You gotta believe." They started believing. Their opponents, the Baltimore Orioles, wish they hadn't. "You gotta believe." "Yeah, but I like it." Why do people buy what they buy? Many service marketers assume that buying decisions are fairly logical. A prospect for a service adds up the cost and benefits of one service, compares it to another's, and chooses the service with the better score. Providers of many services, accountants, lawyers, and financial services particularly, are prone to this notion. But seemingly sophisticated prospects for even sophisticated services do not behave this way, as the strange case of Visa versus American Express clearly suggests. Consider the evidence. Visa cards are accepted at almost 3 times more locations than American Express cards. You can pay back a Visa card immediately or over time. You must pay off an American Express card at the end of each month or suffer substantial penalties and a testy little notice from Chicago. You pay $20 for a basic Visa card and $55 for one from American Express. Now, what truly rational people want from a credit card is utility relative to price. If they're being logical, they want to be able to use the card whenever and wherever they buy and have the option to pay their balance immediately to save interest charges or over time if necessary. Truly rational people also want to pay as little as possible for those benefits. A truly rational person, in other words, chooses a Visa card. Perhaps all of the Earth's rational people do choose Visa cards, but that leaves approximately 25 million Americans who use American Express cards. Why? Because of prestige, apparently. That is, American Express emphasized that membership has its privileges. And that privilege of membership in American Express is in being part of an elite club. Appeal only to a prospect's reason, and you may have no appeal at all. How prospects decide. Choosing the familiar. People choose what seems most familiar. We tend to choose the one we hear the most about. Another small surprise. The evidence suggests that it is better to be known badly than not to be known at all. This is due to a human trait called attribute forgetting. Let's say you hear something negative about a company. As time passes, you tend to forget that negative information. You forget all the attributes and remember only the company name. Then, asked which company you have a better opinion of, the first company or another company you may never have heard of, you choose the familiar company. Even though everything you heard about that company was negative, familiarity wields that much power. You need to make yourself familiar to your prospects. You need to get out there. Familiarity breeds business. Spread your word however you can. How prospects decide, using the most recent data. Now, what do you do against a competitor who is more familiar to your prospects than you are? You try to take advantage of another bias of people, the recency effect. Companies that often present competitive pitches, at least the smarter ones, do everything possible to be the last company to present. It's the home field advantage in many service industries. There are several ways to take advantage of the recency effect. The essential point is that you should always take advantage of this effect with a follow-up that is well-conceived and as powerful as anything in your presentation. This is not the time to sound predictable and only slightly enthusiastic. Take advantage of the recency effect. Follow up brilliantly. How prospects decide. Choosing good enough. People do not look to make the superior choice. They want to avoid making a bad choice. Experts on decision-making call this looking for good enough. It happens day after day and decision after decision. So, whenever you make your pitch, ask yourself, what risks might a prospect see in hiring us? Then, without reminding the prospect of those risks, eliminate the prospect's fear one by one. Forget looking like the superior choice. Make yourself an excellent choice. Then eliminate anything that might make you a bad choice. The anchoring principle. People with little time, almost all people today, are more apt to make first impressions as snap judgments and then base all their later decisions on them. The smart marketer must be aware of this strong tendency. First impressions have never been more critical. They take hold very quickly, and they become the anchors to which you and your success are tied. What anchors have the prospect already attached to you? How can you overcome them? What first impression do you make? What's the first thing you say? The first way that you position your service? Identify and polish your anchors. Risky business. Joel and Judy Wethel are driving from Tampa to Disney World when they're struck with hunger. They begin watching for places to eat, and then choose a Burger King.
Their choice seems odd. They dislike Whopper hamburgers. Why did they choose Burger King? Almost every prospect for every service thinks their alternatives are two unknowns, the one they want the most and the one they fear the least. They do not choose a good experience, they choose to minimize the risk of a bad experience. So, build quality into your service, but take the risk out, too. You have nothing to fear but your client's fear itself. Peggy, your prospect is frightened. You are just this invisible thing, a service, a mere promise that you will do something. She is uneasy, and she is the typical prospect. Often Peggy is so fearful she does not buy, even though she needs and could benefit from your service, and even though you are the best company she could choose. It is less risky for her to do nothing. Always remember, the best thing you can do for a prospect is eliminate her fear. Offer a trial period or a test project. Business is in the details. People feel a need to justify their decisions to themselves, so they look for differences upon which to base their decision. What does this mean to a company in an industry of lookalikes? It means that the more alike two services are, the more important each difference becomes. With meaningful differences difficult to find, prospects look for signals in seemingly trivial differences. In fact, much of effective service management can be described as the careful management of the seemingly inconsequential. Accentuate the trivial. The more you say, the less people hear. Positioning and focus. Fanatical focus. Ask the pizza man. Successful marketing starts with positioning. In its most important essentials, positioning says, 1. You must position yourself in your prospect's mind. 2. Your position should be singular. One simple message. 3. Your position must set you apart from your competitors. And 4. You must sacrifice. You cannot be all things to all people. You must focus on one thing. Domino's vividly illustrates strong service positioning. For years, Domino's never mentioned quality, price, or value. Instead, they relentlessly stressed its speed. 30 minutes or it's on us, ad after ad. As a result, Domino's came to own the distinctive concept of speed in the pizza delivery business. When people thought of fast, reliable delivery, they thought of Domino's. Today, when reporters ask Domino's president, Tom Monahan, the secret of his success, what does he answer? A fanatical focus on doing one thing well. Stand for one distinctive thing, and it will give you a competitive advantage.